Ultimately, this book is an attempt to make sense of what the South's ascendance says about America and to figure out what kind of a place this South is anyway. The South of Jimmy Carter or of Newt Gingrich? The South that elects more blacks to office than anywhere else in America, or the South that elects so many of them from places where they have more political power and less economic opportunity than anywhere else in America? The South where Atlanta managed to put on the ultimate show of the South's renaissance, the 1996 Olympics, largely by selling itself and the contemporary South as a model of interracial harmony, or the South where black churches were being torched by arsonists with terrifying frequency, like a macabre nightmare from the past? The South that, for my tastes, still elects all the wrong people for all the wrong reasons, or the South where I've lived for half my life, where my kids were born, where I'd just as soon stay, the South that feels like home.
Journalist Peter Applebaum, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's radio magazine about books and ideas. Peter Applebaum is here to talk about his new book, Dixie Rising, How the South is Shaping American Values, Politics, and Culture. Soundings is a presentation of the National Humanities Center, which seeks to encourage excellence in scholarship, to strengthen teaching, and to broaden public understanding of the humanities. Once again, Peter Applebaum.
The South has been a lightning rod for our fondest hopes and worst fears, a shadow theater for national guilt, a place to stow the bloody rags we didn't want to see, a scapegoat for our worst failings, a model of an imagined perfect past, a hypothesis for a nation redeemed or a nation damned. Like the movies at the Lumina, that show is probably over. The Southern pageant will go on, but it has become pretty clear that we're all actors, co-conspirators, secret sharers in the drama. Jesus, the South is fine, isn't it? Said Shreve McCannon to Quentin Compson in Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom. It's better than the theater, ain't it? It's better than Ben-Hur, isn't it? Yes and no. The lines are still better, the chariot's gaudier, the plot's more Byzantine, but it ain't no theater, it ain't no Ben-Hur, it's us.
In his new book, Dixie Rising, journalist Peter Applebaum says that the South today unquestionably partakes of modern American mainstream culture. At the same time, it continues to be a region beset with historical contradictions, especially with regard to race. But Peter Applebaum also calls the South a place of grace and faith that's managed to purge itself of most of its old sins. A native New Yorker, Peter Applebaum has lived in and written about the South for 20 years. Based in Atlanta, he serves as national education correspondent for the New York Times.
The old man lay at home in his electric Therapulse hospital bed under a brooding cloud of smoke from his Garcia y Vega cigars. He reached up with his right arm for the steel coat hanger-shaped strap hanging above him so he could sit up and stare you down, eye to eye, as he talked. Sometimes he'd choke and cough from the smoke. Sometimes he'd wince, his eyes closed and muscles tensed up in pain. Sometimes he'd lay silently with a dreamlike look on his face, as if thinking of places and things far away. And sometimes he'd get a startled, panicked look, as if there was something he desperately needed to convey, but there was no way to get it across. Mostly, though, he just stared at you with a fevered gaze as intense as a lantern beaming up from the bottom of a well. "They all talking like me," said George Corley Wallace, pushing out his words in short, hoarse breaths. "Nixon, Reagan, Clinton, welfare reform, crime, big government, taxes on the middle class. They all saying now what I was saying then."
Peter, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
Glad to be here.
Congratulations on Dixie Rising. You have got an immense amount of material that you covered in this book. How in the world did you organize all of this stuff? I mean, one of your arguments is that the South is many things, but it's not a monolith.
This is true. In fact, one of my organizing principles was to try to get as much in as I could. So what I did is I have 12 chapters from 12 different places, each of which tries to evoke a place and an idea. So there's sort of this a chapter from Charlotte as sort of the quintessential New South,
right,
booster city.
Uh-huh.
There's a two-chapter drive across Mississippi trying to gets at all the sort of contradictions of contemporary Mississippi. There are chapters from Atlanta. There's a chapter about labor from a place called Honeypath, South Carolina. So I tried again to evoke both geography and ideas at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Underscoring all of this, Peter, is a kind of an argument that the South really is leading the nation into the next millennium, into the next century. And I recall one of your reviewers, a historian from Duke University, saying that is not necessarily so much a given as what kind of South is going to lead the rest of the country. Tell us about the split personality, the sort of schizophrenia that exists on this cultural and political landscape.
Okay. If I could, just to start with the argument, I mean, when you look at American life, I think in a way that very few people really understand, it's really striking how much of the nation's culture looks like the South these days. You start with politics. President, vice president, House Speaker,
right.
House Majority Leader,
uh-huh.
House Majority Whip, Senate Majority Leader, they're all Southerners.
Never thought we'd see the day, huh?
Not since 1865.
Right, but there they
right,
are.
That's right. And the Republican Party undoubtedly has its base in the South.
Uh-huh.
Bill Clinton has more or less resurrected the Democrats by sort of moving them to the right, in a sense, borrowing a lot of Republican slash Southern ideas.
Uh-huh.
Demographically, where's everybody moving? Between 1970 and 1990, the South grew at twice the rate of the rest of the country. Between now and 2020, of the 10 states that will add the most residents, six are Southern. You think of the conservative drift in terms of values, in terms of the resurgence of religion, even something like country music. And I'm a fan of country music, but 30 years ago, people looked down at country music as sort of this music of hillbilly nitwits. Now it's basically the music of white America. There are twice as many country radio stations as the next biggest format. And one final thing is the role of race. I mean, the South, for most of its history, was the part of the country that was shaped and deformed by race.
Mm-hmm.
Well, race has since been nationalized, and now the rest of the nation is being shaped and deformed by race. In lots of ways, the South's experience with race, rather than being unique, eccentric, odd, turns out to be the nation's experience in the boldest, brightest, sometimes most horrific colors.
Mm-hmm. Well, do I hear you saying, Peter, that the South is providing upbeat, productive, sort of beneficial lessons for the rest of the country? Or are these, in fact, cautionary tales about the way this country deals with this enormous question of skin color?
I think it's a very, very mixed message. And in some ways, and as someone whose politics are fairly liberal, I think the South does reflect a positive trend in terms of, you know, conservative values, in terms of tradition, in terms of sort of this yearning for tradition, constancy, permanence, sanity.
Uh-huh.
And I think in lots of ways that's been positive. I think in terms of race, I think a lot of what the South has exported has been toxic. And you think of the way that Lee Atwater in particular, good Southern boy,
right,
brought racial politics into the, you know, the belly of the national body politic. I don't think that's been a positive trend.
I remember at one point in your book, you say that one of the reasons that you like the South is because of people whose very fundamental values, whether we're talking about race or religion, I'm not sure, are things that you don't like. So here we got this incredible series of contradictions and dilemmas in front of us.
Well, the South has always been a very contradictory place, you know, a place that even, you know, at the worst of segregation was a place where blacks and whites did have a connection with one another that they didn't have in the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's striking, you know, that the rest of the country has often managed to sort of evade its own racial ills by looking down on the South and saying, well, we have met the enemy and it is them.
Right.
It's really striking to me how much of our racial dialogue still points its finger towards the South. If you think of all these movies, Mississippi Burning, Ghosts
right.
of Mississippi,
right.
you know, it's like we have this wonderful, great, big metaphor. And it's a wonderful metaphor because it's all black and white, literally and figuratively. You know who the good guys are. You know who the bad guys are. And I think that's part of the seductive quality of the South for Americans, that they see it as this grand drama in which so many of the nation's biggest dramas have played out. And I think that's comforting, but I think it's illusory. I think the world is much more complicated than we'd like to see it.
It's easy to look to the South and say, yeah, the climate is different there, and everybody talks funny, so that we can locate this kind of, this place for to put the burden of our national guilt when we talk
right.
about serious things.
Right. And particularly in terms of race. I mean, you think of, well, you know, the obvious cliche of the O.J. trial, where you have this complete breakdown of how whites see it and blacks see it. And you go beyond that to the most painful racial incidents of recent years. I mean, Rodney King, Howard Beach, Crown Heights,
right.
All these things. They haven't occurred in the South. But in terms of the national imagery, we still want to think, well, this is something that white Southerners and black Southerners have dealt with.
Tell me about J.B. Stoner, to sound something of a...
To hit a down note here?
Yeah, a very sinister note. Well, who is this man?
He's one of the really, I guess I could use the word, evil people from the South's past. He's a convicted church bomber. And he lives in Cobb County. And I caught him at a Klan rally in Cumming, Georgia. And... you know, I wouldn't want to make too much of him because I think, I mean, the only positive thing you could say about J.B. Stoner is that he is so far off the charts politically now that a guy who at least once had a substantial following as a hardcore defender of segregation and a bigot of the worst sort, even in the South now, does seem like kind of a nutty throwback to an earlier time.
And yet we still have people like David Duke who are more or less in the American political and cultural mainstream. Is this what the lineage of people like J.B. Stoner?
In some ways they go back to Wallace. But the interesting thing about Wallace is how much of the American political debate stems from the language of George Wallace. I mean, you think of George Wallace back in the 60s, and, you know, what he really did is he changed the focus of populist outrage to liberal elitists and, you know, the out-of-touch media and federal judges. And, mm-hmm. you know, the same kind of, you listen to Rush Limbaugh today, and there's very, very little in his vocabulary that differs a lot from George Wallace.
Wallace is the one who got there the first and sort of set the ground rules for
a lot of what
we hear on talk
radio.
Send
them a message. That's what they're still doing today.
Peter, your book is Dixie Rising, How the South is Shaping American Values, Politics, and Culture. The cover of this book, I don't know who did that for you, but it's wonderful. Elvis, we got Martin Luther King Jr., Newt, Eudora Welty, Garth Brooks, the Klan, Coke. You got a blue tick hound, a catfish, the Confederate flag, Stone Mountain. Is that Mahalia Jackson I see down there?
You know, I think it's a generic gospel singer. I'm not sure if it's Mahalia or not.
Yeah. Well, now, these are the stereotypical things that we think about when we say the South. What do you think of when you say the South? I mean, what I'm leading you here to is the 50-cent question. What in the world is a Southerner?
Boy, that's a $3,000 question. I don't know if it's a 50-cent. You know, in fact, you know what a Southerner is a subject you could debate forever. Do you have to be born here? Do you have to whatever? But I think the important thing is what the South is, and I think the South is one, the locus of American conservatism. In lots of ways, it's the locus of the country itself. I mean, one thing that we often forget. I mean, people think of the South as different, odd, outside the national mainstream. But the country began in the South. The first settlement was Jamestown, Virginia, the first permanent settlement. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were written by Southerners. The father of our country was a Southerner. And up to the time of Abraham Lincoln, two-thirds of the presidents were white slaveholding Southerners. And 130 years ago, a war was fought over, you know, the demarcation line between North and South. And the North won, and history is written by the winners. Uh-huh. But in lots of ways, I think the South has slowly been redressing the balance ever since. And it's clearly at the century's end has reached sort of a historic high tide.
Is the Dixie Rising that you write about, Peter, is this, I don't know how to put it, whether it's the result of human or large historical forces, is this the South's revenge on the rest of the country for having lost the Civil War? I know that we have these wonderful ongoing debates, who really lost and what were the ground rules and all of that. What do you think?
Well, I think it is amazing how alive the legacy of the Civil War still is. And you only have to look at these crazy flag flaps and song flaps. I mean, who would have thought 130 years after the Civil War we'd still be battling over the images of that time?
Right.
But I think it partly has to do with, again, with race, how we live in a world, basically, all these symbols are defined by white Southerners. and they mean something completely different to white Southerners and to black Southerners.
I know that you see on television when you get these ugly incidents or these controversies are covered. What is the slogan? It's not racism. It's not bigotry. It's history at work. There's a
heritage, not hate.
Heritage, not hate. Uh-huh. Now, how do you come to that?
You know, I think there's some truth to that. Uh-huh. And again, this is coming from someone who's sort of a Yankee liberal at heart. and for what it's worth, my stance on all these flag fights uh-huh. is that the Confederate flag does not belong on the Georgia state flag because it's too divisive a symbol. And it doesn't belong at the top of the Capitol in South Carolina. Uh-huh. But I think many of the people that fly the flag that believe it belongs there are doing so for really honorable reasons. That to them, it stands for history, heritage, the South, their ancestors, all these big, important things. And, you know, it's sort of easy to stigmatize them as all racists flying the rebel flag, and I think they're not.
What do you think are the primary strengths of the South here at the end of the decade, the beginning of the new millennium? What are its greatest weaknesses? I mean, is your book in any sense a cautionary tale for the rest of the country in that regard?
I think the South has a lot of strengths. Two of them are, one, it's so new. That its cities are much newer than those in the Northeast and the rest of the country, so they have terrific infrastructure. I think it's an easier place to live. I think one thing that's interesting, at the century's end have often been times of nostalgia, when people wanted an easier, simple life, when they're looking towards an unknowable future and looking back to an often idealized past. Mm-hmm. And the South, I think, often sums that up. I think a third strength that the South has really is a wonderful sense of optimism. I mean, it really is the part of the country, I think, more than any other. And I think John Shelton Reed's polls bear this out, where people basically believe that life is getting better.
Hey, we're warmer down here.
Well, that too. Well, listen, you know, I mean, the biggest thing that changed the South may have been air conditioning that made it habitable in the summer.
Right.
So, and I think the biggest weakness that the South has, and it's interesting because it's such a huge national issue, is education. Mm-hmm. I mean, the South has always fared near the bottom at almost any index of educational funding and achievement. And Southern governors, the education secretary and the president, are both former Southern governors.
Right. Well, here you've been a correspondent in Atlanta for the New York Times, and as I understand it, Peter, you've just become the national education correspondent for the Times. Let's pause on this. Why is education, what is going on in education in the South that's particularly important for the rest of the nation? Does it go to race as much as education, or are those two inseparable for you?
We're talking about both. And clearly, the future of the South in terms of education is inextricably linked to how well blacks and whites can find a way to find accommodations in terms of curriculum, in terms of teaching methods, mm-hmm. in terms of busing, all these different things. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot more than that. I mean, the South, as sort of the tail end of the dog in lots of ways in education, was the first really to realize that their future depended so much on improving education. And Clinton, Riley, Lamar Alexander, the governors most associated with the first wave of education reform, were all Southerners. Now it turns out that the South's fixation on improving education has become the nation's. So just as the South realized 20 years ago that it had no hope of sort of realizing its dreams unless it improved its schools, I think the nation has come to the same understanding now.
Well, here we sit in a place called the Research Triangle Park, which after a fashion has furnished something of a model for other parts of the country when we talk about, the coming together of apparently disparate threads, commerce, culture, education, state government, all that sort of thing. I mean, this is the Chamber of Commerce after a fashion talking, but it is a matter of pride, not only here in North Carolina, but throughout the South.
Sure, and the South has been incredibly forward-thinking lots of ways in terms of industrial development. And I think a lot of it does come from, you know, there was this sort of new South booster ethos after the Civil War, the subtext of which was, well, we lost the war, but sooner or later we're going to win the peace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in subtle ways, that mentality still exists. And you know, there's sort of this cliche you sometimes hear about how the nation has been blended out into one homogeneous whole. And if you go to Montgomery or Seattle or Chicago, they're all the same. I don't believe that for a second. Mm-hmm. I mean, and in terms of the way that history still lives, in terms of the role of religion, in terms of ties to the land, in terms of politics, you know, in way after way, it's striking how much, even in places where on the surface they may look like any place else, the old South still lives. And that gets back again to these, you know, in some ways crazy fights over the symbols of the old South. And I think, again, getting back to what's honorable in it, there are worse sins. In a nation of historical amnesiacs, there are worse sins than passionate remembrance.
Right.
And passionate remembrance, to me, is one of the real keys to understanding the South.
Well, now, at one point in your book, Peter, you say that your book, it's called Dixie Rising, it's not history, but it's journalism, and yet here you are talking like a historian. How do you want this book to work for the people who read it?
Well, it's a little of both. I mean, again, I'm certainly not a historian, but what I tried to do was sort of to blend some degree of kind of low-grade scholarship. With high-grade reporting. So It's a combination of, you know, quote-unquote book learning and driving around by the side of the road. And, for instance, in Honey Pass, South Carolina, I ended up hanging out with these guys who were pulling out each other's teeth with pliers by an industrial cable spool one evening. I think it's an interesting hybrid, and, you know, I hope it works. I mean, what I tried to do was both to say something significant and to be a good read. And
now, wait, I can't let that get by. Give us 30 seconds on the guys who were pulling their teeth out.
You don't want 30 seconds. This was in Honey Pass, South Carolina, which is a place that's played an incredibly important role in the labor lore of the South, where there was a tragic labor strike in 1934 in which seven strikers were shot to death. And I was sort of just driving around seeing who I could find, and I found these guys who I can't say their name on the air, but they're a group of guys who just sort of hang out and drink beer.
These are the kind of folks, I take it, who furnish the grotesque stereotype that a lot of writers, Southern as well as non-Southern, will seize upon to create fictional or creative portraits of the South that the rest of the country looks at and says, yeah, they're all still a bunch of retrograde idiots inbred down there.
Now, well, you know, a writer named Jack Temple Kirby has talked about what he calls the Southern Catch-22, in which Southerners can't be seen as Southerners unless they're grotesque, outlandish, you know, different. So we tend to see either the Savage South or the Sunny South, you know, sort of Gone with the Wind or these guys pulling out each other's teeth with pliers. So they're all there, but I think the trick is to knit them together into a fabric that makes sense rather than picking out the most outlandish pieces and saying, aha, that's it.
Right. Peter, again, your book is Dixie Rising. Why do you like living in the South? Let me get real personal with you. You went to school in the South, and you've been here for, what, more than 20 years?
We can't say Duke because we're in Research Triangle.
Well, we, around here, we call it the University of New Jersey at Durham.
Yes, I've heard that.
But what about this? Why is it that the South is home to you very personally?
I really like the South, and this will probably sound horrible, for very unprofound reasons. It's an incredibly easy place to live. I mean, the people are nicer, the weather is better, the pace of life is saner, the history is richer. I think some real Southerners would sort of take it as an insult, because I don't think it's the most grandiose notions of the South that speak to me. But again, particularly at a time when people feel the pace of life is too fast, that the world is too crazy, the South, in a way, does sort of speak to older virtues, saner times. It's an easier place to live, and in lots of ways, a nicer place to live.
Peter, here is a footnote to our conversation. What do you want for the future of your two little Southerners? Their name, as I recall, are Ben and Emma.
Oh, they'll be so happy you mentioned their name.
Well, I'm curious about this because, I mean, in a way, your book speaks to the future as much as it does to kind of surveying the present and looking back to where the South came from and what made it. What do you want for these two kids of yours?
Boy, that's a hard question. Well, two things. You know, in terms of what the South speaks to in their future. I mean, the South is, in lots of ways, I think, summarizes in race both the best and worst of America. And, you know, I think if there's any real hope for racial accommodation in the South, it will basically come from taking the best lessons of the South's past and missing out on the worst ones or rejecting the worst ones. You know, and beyond that, the other thing that I think is really appealing in the Southern experience is the degree to which in both sort of trivial and profound ways, there is this emphasis on people dealing with each other on a one-to-one level. I mean, there's this sort of accent on manners, mores, mm-hmm. in the broadest sense. And, you know, if that part of the Southern experience leaches into them, you know, the best elements of sort of the compulsive amiability and conviviality of Southern life, I think that'd be wonderful. And I think it actually has.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you for this conversation on Soundings. You are Peter Applebaum. You live in Atlanta. You were you still work for the New York Times. You were the Atlanta bureau chief, and now you are the national education correspondent for the Times. Your book is Dixie Rising: How the South is Shaping American Values, Politics, and Culture. From one honorary Southerner to another, I admire what you're doing, and I wish you well in your work.
Thanks. I really enjoyed our conversation.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is a presentation of the National Humanities Center, which seeks to encourage excellence in scholarship, to strengthen teaching, and to broaden public understanding of the humanities. I'll be back in just a moment to tell you where to write for an audio tape of this program.
Georgia. Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia. Georgia, a song of you.
You're listening to Soundings. For an audio tape, call area code 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 862. The center's email address is nhc@ga.unc.edu. A program note now, a few cabins remain on the National Humanities Center study session to the Greek islands and Turkey aboard the exclusively chartered four-masted yacht Sea Cloud. Information provided 1-888-650-TOUR, 1-888-650-8687. And finally this week, something of a personal note. After this broadcast, Soundings will no longer be a program of the National Humanities Center, but plans are underway for a change in institutional affiliation beginning with next week's show. As the producer and host of Soundings since 1980, it's been my good fortune to collaborate with the extraordinary scholars, visitors, staff, and benefactors who make up the National Humanities Center. To each of them, thank you. But special thanks to you, our listeners. Please stay tuned. For Soundings, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.